Hello, everybody. Thank you, Carlita. Oh, it's such a pleasure to be here, to be back. It's been a few weeks. I know Sylvia's been here the last couple of weeks, and I am really happy to be here, and I want to welcome everybody. Some of you, we know each other. Some are new. Some I haven't seen in a really long time. Andrew, it's especially sweet to see you. It's been a really long time. Thank you. Is anybody here for the very first time? The Spirit Rock. Sebastian, welcome. Welcome, welcome. Thank you for joining us. Where are you joining us from geographically?
Canada.
Denver, did you say?
No, Canada. Calgary, Alberta.
Calgary. How's the air today? How's it going?
It's good. It's been so-so. It's a little foggy.
A little foggy, okay.
Yeah.
Good. Thinking about so many people who are braving these fires that are everywhere. Well, thank you for joining us. I am glad that you're here. Anybody else here? Kirsta.
Yes, hello. I'm from Talent, Oregon.
Welcome.
Glad to be here. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for joining. Thank you for joining. It's always such a pleasure when people find us and come to our sangha. So, did I miss anybody? Is anybody else here for the very first time? All right. Well, thank you all for being here. Thank you for coming back. Our sangha is really important to me, and I know that it is also important to you because you're here. I join you from about 300 miles north of San Francisco in a little town called McKinleyville, which is in the on the unceded land of the Wiat and the Redwoods on the coast. And I'm just very, very happy to be here. If you would like to type into the chat where you are calling in from geographically, that'd be great because then we get a sense of our sangha if you feel like it. You just type in where you are. Or actually, if you want to locate yourself, how are you today? How's your heart? What are you joining with? Dale's here from Cotati and Larkspur, Portland, Massachusetts. Betsy, hi. Quebec and Oakland. And Lucy's here from London. Thank you. Isn't this fun? I mean, even if just a few people type in, this is great. La Mesa in San Francisco. Okay, so here's the other thing I like to do so we can just say hello to each other. I keep my view on gallery view. I don't spotlight myself because that's really weird. I can't just spotlight myself as the speaker. But what I think is really sweet, why I like to keep my screen on gallery view is that I really feel like I'm in the room with everybody. And I can see you all, and it really feels It's heartwarming, it feels really good. So just take a look at each other. Just take a look. Nobody knows who's looking at who, when, or where. And this is just a way of connecting with our sangha, with each other. I love doing this. Everybody belongs, right? We're all connected in one way or another, and we're connected today by our commonality of showing up here, of showing up here. So how will our morning, our 2-hour retreat will go is that we'll begin shortly with an arriving meditation, and then I will offer some Dharma thoughts before our longer meditation. We'll have a longer meditation. I'll give a fuller Dharma talk. And within all of that, I welcome and invite your engagement. Questions, thoughts, reflections. There's so much knowledge and wisdom and experience here with everybody that I really value what everybody brings in. So that's how we'll go. So let's begin with an arriving meditation, finding a posture that works well in your body, and remembering that meditation postures include sitting and standing and reclining, even walking, if that's what's helpful for you. Eyes open or closed. And with the next few breath cycles, Really being aware, breathing in this moment, exhaling out, settling into this moment. If you'd like to close your eyes, do that. If not, soft, gentle gaze downward. And as you arrive and settle into this time, there's a way in which the body will find its most natural, easeful posture. So inviting the body and the mind to find that place of settling and being here. Noticing if there's anywhere in the body specifically that might feel a little tight, a little stuck, a little bit of holding, any habitual places. And meeting that holding with a caring heart. Like, oh yes, body, this is what happens. And with each breath out, maybe softening there any amount. Might be the jaw, might be the belly or the face. Softening in here. And then bringing to mind for a little bit of inquiry and reflection, something that you have learned in this practice of awareness and compassion, rooted in wisdom and non-harming. What are the teachings or a specific teaching, something you've learned along the way that you trust, that bolsters your confidence to come back again and again? Something that you know, like with a capital K, you know this. Something you've learned that you trust, that is in some ways a refuge for you. It's a reliable place that supports your deepest place. What is it that you've learned that you know to be true? And then if something does come up, you don't have to look too hard for it. Don't search too hard if it's not arising. But if it comes right up, maybe just offering that piece of that which you know, almost an internal bow of recognition and gratitude, and let that accompany you. That is that piece of faith in a practice, trust and confidence that is so necessary to keep going, to keep coming back. Let it be right with you. Okay. I find it very helpful to drop in a question often in an arriving meditation. There's a way in which it sets a tone. It brings me a little bit deeper into a practice. And I do like reminding myself, what is it? Are there specific teachings or one today that is supporting me? Because it keeps me connected to the practice. It keeps me connected to the ways, to the things that I've learned that do support my well-being. So I want to do a little bit of a recap. I was here the last two Wednesdays of August, and during those talks, I never finished what I wanted to say, and which is so typical of me, of having way more than I planned to offer than I can possibly get in. So one of the things that I said I really wanted to talk about was the practice of sadha, the practice of faith, and we will do that. Faith translated as confidence and trust, and we will do that today. But what I want to recap on is just this small section of what I talked about on the 30th of August, and you can get the talk if you want to go back to that, is this beautiful three-part practice that I've been paying attention to from the Zen Peacemakers. Anybody familiar with the organization Zen Peacemakers? Couple people maybe. Okay. So it's a beautiful organization that was started in 1994 from Roshi Bernie Glassman, who was a very important, influential Zen teacher who was committed to connecting service and contemplative practice for the benefit of all beings, especially under-resourced beings. So the mission was to realize that through contemplative social action, we can be a force for good. And there were three tenets, not were, there are. Zen Peacemakers is a very active organization. And there are three primary tenets of the organization. And I want to just go over those because they dovetail exactly with how do we cultivate a faith in a practice in our lives, and especially in maybe troubling times. Maybe it's always troubling times. But these three tenets are, first, not knowing, being able to show up not knowing. And this goes all the way back to what Suzuki Roshi taught about beginner's mind, right? That in the beginner's mind, there are many possibilities, but in the expert's mind, there are few. So how often can we actually let go of fixed views about ourselves and each other and just show up not knowing? What can I learn here? How do I drop my own opinions and views so I can be a better listener, so I can really, really show up open-hearted? It does not mean drop your values, but it does mean to suspend our loyalty to our own opinions long enough to hear what else might be happening. This is not easy. You know, these tenets that I'm going to offer you here is just as this little bit of a recap. I'm not saying this is easy. And this is why Zen Peacemakers have been around for a long time, because it's hard to make peace, right? It is hard to do that. So to show up not knowing, letting go of fixed ideas, goes right to what are our core beliefs? And in those core beliefs, what are those core beliefs that really do support our well-being? But what are the core limiting beliefs? And this is the tricky part, because we all have views and opinions. We've all been conditioned by our circumstances, from our genetics, certainly, to how we were raised, to our communities, to our education, to how we are now. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's just how it is. We are conditioned by our circumstances. But what are these core beliefs that we each hold that might hold us back. That's why it's a limiting belief, a belief that we can generalize. People who do this are that. That's pretty big core limiting belief when we make generalizations like that. So to actually touch into your own values, your own belief systems, and you may not be able to take an inventory of that right now. That's not really how it works. What happens is when we come up against a situation that challenges us, it's in that moment that we might say, oh, right, so I have a bit of a constricted mind here, a bit of a constricted heart, because I think things should be a certain way. So when we think things should be a certain way, that leads us into maybe a constricted place, especially if it is something that doesn't really support our well-being. And this is why it's a big practice, because to study, to come in contact with what is a core limiting belief is pain. It can be really painful because it challenges our belief systems, our views. But how we can come into a not knowing by understanding that we all have some limiting beliefs, and it's a practice of opening that up. How we open that up is through a practice of reframing. So you've heard me say many times that we can use this question, what else is true, as a way to broaden our perspective, right? You've heard me say that. So we can take what is still true. What is still true might be whatever the circumstances are. But what else is true? What are the possibilities? This is a reframe. So this is an important piece. And there's actually, it turns out, a circuit in the brain that is connected to the ability to reframe. This was studied and discovered by Richie Davidson, brain researcher, that there is a whole circuit in the brain that is dedicated to our ability to expand our outlook. So not knowing requires that expansive outlook, the ability to reframe. And way before there was brain science, you know, thousands of years before that, the Buddha said in the Metta Sutta, at the very end of the Metta Sutta, where it says, by not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, who has released addiction to sense desires, is free from suffering. So we know this, that by not holding to fixed views, it opens up a whole world. And I think this is what Roshi Glassman was saying about not knowing. Can we not know? So that's the first tenet. The second is bearing witness. Bearing witness to the joy and the suffering of the world. And so this is what he said about bearing witness. The practice of bearing witness is to see all of the aspects of a situation, including our attachments and judgments. So you can see how this fits right in with not knowing. They have to go together. You can't not know and not bear witness. This is a parallel practice. And when you bear witness, you open up to the uniqueness of whatever is arising, and you meet it just as it is. How many times have we heard in our practice to meet our experience just as it is? It's so hard because of Vedana, because of pleasant and unpleasant, because of everything that it takes, because of greed, because of ill will, because we don't necessarily see clearly. How do we witness just what it is? But when we do, when we have those moments of courage, and I think it takes incredible bravery and courage, this is a practice of bravery and courage. It strengthens our capacity to listen, right? And when we can strengthen our capacity to listen to ourselves and another, we get a more nuanced view of any situation where we can say, all right, this is still true. What else is true? How can I be with all of this? But it is completely the ability to not know, the ability to bear witness is woven throughout with how the three poisons work: greed and non-greed, ill will transforming to non-ill will, delusion, ignorance transforming to clear seeing, and then that completely woven through with the truth of impermanence, that everything is always changing all of the time, that dukkha is a given, and that everything is connected to everything else. So one of my favorite things about studying the Dharma is seeing these connections, and I hope you do too, is that we're connecting the dots all the time in this practice. These teachings that we study, that we're offered, that we discover in ourselves, they're not separate. There's no one teaching that doesn't touch another teaching. And I think that this is actually one of the most exciting parts for me of studying the Dharma and being in this practice, are those moments when I see how things are connected. And they're not only connected one way, but just the practice of not knowing and bearing witness is so hard because of Vedana, the second foundation of mindfulness, because we're conditioned so deeply to like and dislike, towards comfort and discomfort, towards all the ways pleasant and unpleasant influence what we think, what we say, and what we do. But when we really remember, I'll speak for myself, when I really remember how transitory everything else is, how dukkha is just part and parcel of living a life, but I have the ability to change my outlook. It doesn't mean I'm dismissing what is painful, but it does mean that I'm expanding my view so I can hold more, so I can meet more. That includes joy. So we're not only talking about what's difficult, we're also talking about there's some joy, some happiness and contentment that can be experienced in this more opened view of not knowing and bearing witness. Are you with me on this? Yeah? Okay, good. And then the last of these three tenets is to take action. Take caring action. Because when we are truly present and our opinions are in abeyance and we say, what else can I learn from this? The next caring action, I think, makes itself known. Maybe it becomes really obvious. And this is another way of saying this is we get out of our own way. Have you ever had that experience of just getting out of your own way? And I think that that is what not knowing and bearing witness is. It's courageous, it's brave, and you say, okay, here I am. How can I be helpful? What can I learn? When do I need help? The next caring action occurs. Wendell Berry sums it up really beautifully in his poem called Our Real Work. It may be that when we no longer know what to do, we've come to our real work. And that when we no longer know which way to go, we've come to our real journey. The mind that is not baffled is not employed. The impeded stream is the one that sings. Isn't that great? The mind that is not baffled is not employed. Like if you're not wondering and thinking, it's, you know, we're checked out. The impeded stream is the one that sings. Because usually life doesn't just flow without any kind of obstacles. There are rocks, there are trees, there's all kinds of stuff in the way. This is just how it is. So it's obviously very metaphorical. So we know that this is not easy, to show up, to bear witness, to be so present and open and loving and giving and all of these things. We do it anyway. It's hard, but we do it anyway. And this is the path of the Bodhisattva that I've been talking about also, and really, really loving sinking into studying how the path of the Bodhisattva, the one who meets this suffering world and says, okay, I got to meet it. This is the truth of it. I got to meet it. How can I be helpful? This is what we do. And what I love about this, and this is another teaching that comes, that's thousands of years old, I think, that comes from, well, maybe not thousands, a long time ago, from the 3rd century, Rabbi Tarfon in the Talmud, who says, it's not upon you to finish the work, but you're not free to avoid it. Right? So that's the paradox. It's not upon you to finish the task, but you are not free to avoid it. So what is our role? This is our practice also. How can I be helpful? When do I need to pull back? When can I show up? And we need everybody. Everybody has something really valuable to bring, and in your own way and in your own time. But our task is to stay engaged. So the last thing I want to bring in before we move into our meditation was this beautiful piece that I heard from Rebecca Solnit. And Rebecca's a brilliant writer and thinker in engaged work. And she's doing a lot of writing and thinking about climate right now. She's been writing for probably 20 or 30 years. And she did an interview with James Shaheen on Tricycle Talks last month. And they were talking about how to be hopeful and connect with beauty and joy and thrive and shift our outlook and understand that none of us is going to save everybody. And so we could look at the Bodhisattva vow that says, I vow to save all sentient beings. Well, we know that's an impossible task, but what we vow to do is show up and do what we can. So she was talking about what happened in Katrina. And, Katrina was a long time ago, and we keep having more Katrinas. So we can just talk about Katrina as maybe emblematic for all of these natural disasters that are happening around the world. And that the impossibility of saving everybody, but the necessary task of showing up and helping in some way. And this is what she said. Get your boat in the water. You're not going to rescue everybody, but it's not your job to do it all by yourself. And rescuing somebody is deeply meaningful, even if you can't rescue everybody. And in Katrina, nobody rescued everybody, but a lot of people rescued somebody. So get your boat in the water is what the task is here. And this whole thing bears repeating from the last talk because it's just stirring around in me. And this is what is alive in my own practice. And what I want to do when I show up here is to share with you what I'm learning in my own practice, because we're in this together. So it's not up to each one of us to save everybody, because we can't, but we can be helpful to one person. And if we're helpful to one person, that matters. It really matters. So any questions on anything that I said? Okay, then let's move into our meditation. I think we'll sit for about 25 minutes. So please find a posture that works well in your body. And again, you might recline, sit, stand. You might choose walking meditation, whatever you like. Letting the body find its own natural posture. Turning the awareness inward, sensing the climate inside. Breathe and know you're breathing. Aware of sensation and the body. Sensing into the state of mind, the state of heart today. And it occurs to me that The first principle of the Abhidhamma, which is Buddhist psychology, is to see the inner nobility and beauty of all beings. And we are included in all beings. Sensing into your fundamental goodness, the warmth of heart, whatever amount of steadiness of mind that you have right now, the fact that you're here says so much. The fact that you're here is a commitment to your well-being and those around you. Many teachings start, O nobly born, you who are the sons and daughters of the awakened ones, the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas. Remember who you are, your luminous mind, the goodness of your heart. Trust it. Return to it. It is home. So finding that place that feels most natural for you to settle your awareness, whether it's in the experience of breathing, in and out, the breath coming and going, maybe right where you feel your breath the most, the belly, the chest, the nostrils. Maybe it's in a sensation in the body, right where the body is connected to the furniture or the floor. Or perhaps today it's your metta practice. Whatever meditation practice you find that feels exactly right for you right now, do that. And of course, the mind will wander, and it's not a problem. It's just what the mind does. And when you notice, come back to that place where you can settle and begin again. Being gentle, kind, curious, and persistent. And we'll sit quietly. And once again, if you're noticing any place in the body that's holding, see if you can soften there. It might be the brow or the jaw, unhinging the jaw, maybe turning the head just a little bit to loosen the neck, dropping the shoulders, any amount, relaxing the hands and the belly. So easy for habitual tightness to come about. And letting the breath move. Comfortable mind and comfortable breath. The heart softens. Just being here. letting any amount of stillness and peace and quiet that's arising, let that be known. Taking it in, experiencing in this moment any amount of quiet. Resting there if you can. And with this quiet that's here, noticing any softening of the mind heart, relaxing of the habitual holding if there is, and inviting yourself to truly rest, not needing to be anything, to do anything, accomplish anything. In this meditation now is the invitation to rest. Rest in the awareness of just this, this breath, this body, this mind heart. And drawing the awareness into the heart center now. This beautiful way to begin to draw our meditation to an end, but it's not over. But we come into the space of the heart center. And if you like, placing a hand on the chest to directly connect the warmth of your own body with itself and the goodness of your heart. I want to offer you today some phrases that I think of as compassion phrases, a little bit different from traditional metta phrases. But first, imagining breathing in and out of the heart space, softening, opening, nurturing this heart. And then, if you like, repeating this silently to yourself. May I accept myself just as I am, right in this moment. May I accept myself just as I am, right in this moment. May I surround my limitations and challenges with respect and care and love. May I surround my limitations and challenges with respect and care and love. And because we need each other, we are part of each other. May I be supported with strength, steadiness, and courage. May I be supported with strength, steadiness, and courage. And out of the blessings, the outcome, the goodness of this practice. May I rest in the beauty and goodness of my awakening heart. This is our inner nobility. May I rest in the goodness and beauty of my awakening heart. And from Rosemary Watola Trommer, this is a poem called More Love, More Love. If sorrow is how we learn to love, then let us learn. Already enough sorrow's been sown for whole continents to erupt in astonishing tenderness. Let us learn. Let compassion grow rampant like sunflowers along the highway. Let each act of kindness replant itself into acres and acres of widespread devotion. Let us choose love as if our lives depend on it. The sorrow is great. Let us learn to love greater, riotous love, expansive love, love so rooted, so common, we almost forget the world could look any other way. Welcome back. So here's this beautiful piece from Pema Chodron that pops up in my reminders periodically. She said, if your everyday practice is to open to all of your emotions, to all the people you meet, to all the situations you encounter, without closing down and trusting that you can do that, then that will take you as far as you can go. And then you'll understand all of the teachings that anyone has ever taught. I want to read that to you again. If your everyday practice, so this is the important piece here, if your everyday practice is to open to all of your emotions, all of the people you meet, all of the situations you encounter without closing down, trusting that you can do that, then that will take you as far as you can go. And then you'll understand all of the teachings anyone has ever taught. I think that is the same as not knowing, bearing witness, and taking caring action. Our teachers are telling us the same thing over and over again. Show up, be open, be curious, be willing, be brave, listen in. You'll be able to act skillfully from that. So this is another example of how we can start connecting the dots on these teachings. So where we can understand them conceptually, maybe from an academic point of view, but then we start experiencing them. What is it like to really show up? How is it to really experience loving kindness? Self-compassion, compassion for others. And then when we take it from a conceptual place into an experiential place, there's a deeper knowing that happens, right? There's the realizing that happens. And out of that comes embodying. And the embodiment may be akin to awakening. So this is this framework that I think is essential as we study any of these teachings, as we study anything, is to, first, we have to understand it conceptually, of course. But there's a difference between understanding and experiencing, right? That's the aha, oh, now I get it. In the, oh, now I get it, that's the realizing. And then it becomes part of us, becomes real. This is the embodiment. So, how do we show up not knowing? How do we bear witness? How do we trust that the next caring action that our wisdom is going to guide us, that somehow everything that we've learned You know, actually, I want to go back to what Kirsta said. I think is a really important piece around this is a different kind of constellation, and we're going to wrap ourselves around a constellation. Or actually what Nancy said, here's a six-day-old baby who had surgery, had heart surgery, and now has this other big thing going on. How do we show up for all of that? And how we show up for all of that is this not knowing, is, okay, I'm here. What is the next best thing to do? But underpinning that is the practice in our Buddhist practice of sadha, which is the Buddhist word, the Pali word for faith, more specifically translated as trust or confidence. Or my favorite translation of sadha is to place the heart upon. To place the heart upon. So I place my heart upon this path of practice that keeps supporting my well-being, that keeps showing me what all the different ways that greed and ill will and ignorance can show up in my life, but all the different ways that I can train and practice in uprooting those difficulties, transforming greedy graspiness, me, to generosity, openness, we. How do we open that up? All the ways in which when I get an ignoble thought, a closed mind, unkind, clenched thought, that I can notice that thought and work with it. Is this based on some fixed view? Is it based on my fear? Is it based, can I open out to another way of thinking? Here comes a baby we didn't expect. Okay, we're going to wrap our arms around this. Here comes a baby we thought was going to be one way and now has this very big illness. What are we going to do? We're going to wrap ourselves around this. So we need some trust, some confidence to place the heart upon our inner nobility, right? Oh, nobly born. We can do this. So when we place our heart upon, when we have a commitment to a practice that supports our well-being, that's how we do those things. That is how we can come back to both the expansive continuum line of joy and sorrow, because life includes all of it. And you all know that, and we all experience it. And there are times where we can, you know, sometimes we can get that expression or hear the expression in our practice to hold both, to hold the full range of experience. But sometimes we can't. Sometimes holding is too heavy. So I like to shift that language to, can we meet it? What part of me can meet what is happening? What is mine? What is not mine? How do I engage in what I can do, knowing what I can't do? So there's this faith, there's this trust and confidence in the teachings, confidence in our own true north, confidence in what we've learned that says, you know, we can come back. We keep doing this over and over and over again, and we need each other to do it. So in our practice, there's often taught four kinds of faith, and I'll just use the word faith, but I use it interchangeably with trust or confidence, taking the next step. So the first is this, what's called, known as bright faith. The four that we're going to go through are bright faith, borrowed faith, verified faith, and abiding faith. So let's begin with bright. Bright faith is like falling in love. Do you remember when you first came to practice, or maybe when you first fell in love, and you have that feeling of, oh yeah, oh, there's something so right about this. This is where I belong. This is what I'm going to do. And we can be all in. We can get completely single-minded Like, you know, can sit down and learn to meditate and decide you're going to meditate 6 hours a day because it's so, you know, because you love it so much, or you decide, oh, you know, whatever it is. But we get very much all in, single-minded, that kind of infatuation. And it's actually a beautiful experience to be so moved by something, to feel that so deeply that, oh, this is where I belong. I'm just going to keep doing this because it's really supporting me. And, you know, the single-mindedness is that we can get tunnel vision, like this is the only thing that can be good, which we know that changes, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But the benefit of this bright faith is a certain amount of trust and energy that can be born out of that. Virya, the Pali word for energy, it keeps us coming back and going and going. The Zen teacher Rafe Martin says, maybe we step out again after that sitting a little lighter, a little steadier, a little happier, a little less heavily there, a bit more present here, and so a bit more capable of just a little more spontaneous kindness and generosity. That's what happens out of bright faith. Like, we start seeing the benefits. And when we feel better, we behave better, right? That's just how that goes. But then bright faith can flicker, right? Something happens, time goes on, and many things can change us. And it just, like, infatuation just goes away. We get used to it. It maybe is just the light dims on it a little bit. And doubts arise. And doubt is so natural, isn't it? Like, why am I doing this? I'm not sure why I'm doing this. I thought it was so great, and now I sit in meditation and nothing's really happening. I'm just falling asleep, or my feet fall asleep, my back hurts. I'm not really sure what I'm doing. Maybe I'm just avoiding my life. You know, this is the kind of thing that can happen. But there are a couple of different kinds of doubt. And there's the kind of doubt that can keep us stuck, right? That we just say, I don't know. I don't think I can do this. Everybody else can do this better than me, but I'm not really sure what this benefit is. And that is sort of the doubting Thomas, where we throw the baby out with the bathwater when it gets a little bit hard or boring. Have you ever been bored in meditation? Of course, right? Something gets boring. You're like, I don't want to do this. You know, so then we notice the boredom. That's one of the hindrances, of course, right? Like, inattention, like, this is just not juicy anymore. Can I stick with it? But the other kind of doubt that is really energizing is a doubt that invites inquiry, a doubt that says, huh, how come it's so boring now and it wasn't boring a week ago? What's happening? Where's my mind? What's happening in my heart? And Haikun, the great Zen master, also said, at the bottom of great doubt lies great awakening. So when we really have the courage to inquire, what's happening here? I'm going to stick with it. There are openings that happen. There really are openings that can happen. And so out of this borrowed faith, you know, maybe what we need to do is bum some faith off of somebody else. Like, we come to Sangha. We just say, okay, I'm just going to go because look at all of these other 40 people who are here, and there's something else going on. I'm going to borrow some juju from just showing up, and it reinvigorates me. Here's a sweet story that I love. This comes from one of Mark Nepo's books. It's called Things That Join the Sea and Sky. That's the name of the book. And this is just an excerpt from one story. Ketut was a great teacher because she claimed to know nothing. Many wanted to work with her. Some would make long journeys in hopes of studying with her, but she disavowed any notion that she accepted students. To those who showed up, she'd simply say, "Let's just walk together for a while and listen." Three young seekers met in Amsterdam on their way to find her. Gail, a potter from Tucson, Ben, a financial advisor from Dallas, and Jane, a yoga instructor from Portland. And Gail said, "I heard she's very quiet." And Ben added, "I heard she doesn't take many students." And Jane worried to herself that she might be stern. So they shrugged and they laughed and they made her way, their way. And a week later, they were sitting with Ketut on a plateau near her small home, which overlooked a meandering river. And she said, "You've come a long way to meet yourself." And Ben was eager. "Well, there's so much I want to know." And Ketut replied, "You know, there's a line in the Talmud that reads, why ruin a perfectly good question with the answer?" And Gail spoke up, "Well, then, are there no answers?" So Ketut went on and she said, "You know, life unravels the urge to look for an answer. Instead, we're asked to think of questions as teachers to walk with. We're asked to meet questions, not answer them, to give questions away like bread." So when we're in that place of not knowing, of boredom, of doubt, of restlessness, of agitation, can we live inside those questions and actually connect with those questions and trust that, this part of faith, to trust there's something going on here? And I think in Zen practice, my understanding of koan practice is that deep inquiry, is it engages the mind, engages the heart. What can I learn here? What is happening here? And how do we cultivate this trust and faith in each other? And coming back to that piece of inner nobility. I think this is such an important piece, and maybe this is why it's the first principle in the Abhidhamma, is to see the inner nobility and beauty of all beings. So here's a beautiful piece. I want to read this to you from Jack Kornfield's book, The Wise Heart. And this is on seeing this inner nobility, which then bolsters this faith when it's shaky for us. And here's a practice about seeing the secret goodness. Wait for a day when you awaken in a fine mood, when your heart is open to the world. If such days are rare, choose the best you have. Before you start out for work, set the clear intention that during the morning, you'll look for the inner nobility of three people. Carry that intention in your heart as you speak or work with them. Notice how this perception affects your interaction with them, how it affects your own heart, how it affects your own work. Then choose five more days of your best moods and do this practice on each of those days. After looking at three people a day in this way five times, set a clear intention to practice seeing the secret goodness for a whole day with as many people as you can. Of course, you'll find certain people difficult, and so save them for later. And practice first with those whose nobility and beauty is seen most easily. When you've done this as best you can for a day, choose one day a week to continue this practice for a month or two. Upping the ante, right? Getting a little harder. Finally, as you become naturally able to see the secret goodness, expand your practice, add more days, try practicing on days that are more stressful. Gradually include strangers and difficult people until your heart learns to silently acknowledge and bless all whom you meet. Aim to see as many beings as you can with a silent, loving respect. Go through the day as if you were the Dalai Lama undercover. Go through the day as if you were the Dalai Lama undercover. So this is how we cultivate, you know, when our faith, our trust, our confidence gets shaky. We rely on these teachings. This is why I asked you in the very beginning of our morning, what are those teachings that you know to be true, that support you, that bolster your confidence? So this bright faith leads to this borrowed faith when things get shaky. But when we come back to seeing our goodness and the goodness of others, and we go through the day as if we're the Dalai Lama undercover, it can really reinvigorate our confidence and our trust. And then next is this verified faith, finding our footing in our direct experience, the benefit of practice. We know something good is happening. And you remember the Kalama Sutta, this teaching from the Buddha that says, find out from your own experience what leads to your well-being and what decreases your suffering. And the story, the reason it's called the Kalama Sutta, K-A-L-A-M-A, is that the story goes that because the Buddha was itinerant, he was in the community of the Kalamas, and they came to him and said, so many teachers come to us and say, this is my way, this is the way, this is what you need to do to reach awakening. What's your way, awakened one, O venerable sir? And he said, don't believe me. Don't believe what I'm going to tell you. That's not what I'm going to teach. What I want you to do is pay attention to your own experience. What, when you do it, leads to greed and ill will and ignorance? And stop doing it. And what, when you do it, leads to non-greed, generosity, love, compassion, kindness, and clear knowing? Do that. And it's only from your own experience, from trusting your own experience, will you come to this awakening. And ehipasiko is the word. That's the Pali word that means encouraging investigation. I love that. Ehipasiko, from your own experience, find out from yourself. But it is an encouraging investigation. And it's such a confidence-building, trust-building, faith-building quality to trust your own inquiry, to say what's happening here, and to know that you can do this. I think it's one of the most powerful teachings, because when somebody whom we respect sees in us our capacity and says, I know you can do it, find out from your own experience. You don't have to doubt your experience. Trust your experience. You can do this. And that, in that way, there's a certain faith that gets verified, a trust that gets verified, because we have this growing confidence in ourselves. The Buddha said, what, when I do it, will be for the welfare of myself and others. Do that. And Abe Lincoln famously said, when I do good, I feel good. When I do bad, I feel bad. That's my religion. So it's that simple too. You know, we can really bring it down to non-complicated ways of understanding this when we are paying attention. But we have to be present for our lives in order to know, oh, when I do this, this, and this, I feel pretty good and I act pretty well. I can show up wholeheartedly. And that's what we want to do. And because it's hard to be a person, and because we are so human, we're not going to always get it right. And it's okay to not always get it right. And that's why we need the practices of compassion. We need the practices of taking responsibility for ourselves and saying, I'm so sorry, I blew it. This is how I blew it. I caused harm. I'm not going to do that again. So that takes courage and bravery, right? Also that. Here's another story from Terry Tempest Williams from her book called When Women Were Birds that exemplifies this. In the arid foothills of the Wasatch Mountains, the Milky Way arched over us. It was the nightly path our eyes crossed before we went to sleep. This was my personal universe with its own inherent truths. Truth for me was based on what I could see and hear and touch and taste, more trustworthy than any religious doctrine, right? This is what the Buddha said. Be present with all of this. Rufous-sided towhees scratched in the understory of last year's leaves. Lazuli buntings were turquoise exclamation marks singing in a canopy of green, and blue-gray gnatcatchers became commas in an ongoing narrative of wild nature. My inspiration were birds, were winged. Magpies, evening grosbeaks, and scrub jays were family. Turkey vultures soared overhead, casting unexpected shadows during summer heat. Rattlesnakes were our complication to a life lived outside. We heard them first, saw them second, coiled, and before we counted to three, we ran. Clouds became our focal point. Hang on one moment. Pardon me. Can you just see it? You know, all these birds, all this beauty in nature, and then there's the rattlesnake. Okay, one, two, three, I'm out of here. One day, however, as I was sitting in our treehouse, I spotted a white bird perched directly above me. It was unlike anything I'd ever seen. I went into the house to call my grandmother, still watching the ghost bird through the glass sliding doors that faced the trees. I explained the size and shape of this mysterious bird to be that of a robin, only without a brown back, black head, and red breast. She listened carefully. We both had our bird books in hand. "Perhaps it's an albino," she said, "a bird without pigmentation, even its eyes without color." That very word, albino, was a revelation to me. She might as well have said, "of the spirit world." It was indeed a robin, the most common of birds, free of its prescribed dressings, white with red eyes. I was inspired and called her the Holy Ghost. When I repeated this finding to our local Audubon chapter as an 8-year-old bird watcher, the president said that because of my age, he could not legitimately count it as a credible sighting. My grandmother simply shook her head and said, "You know what you saw. The bird doesn't need to be counted, and neither do you." Now that is verified faith. That is ahipasiko. That is saying, I'm not doubting what I'm seeing. I am learning. And back to our core limiting beliefs, let's bring this in here. A core limiting belief that says that a child's experience isn't as valid as an adult's experience. What kind of harm is caused from that? Right? What kind of harm? So this is what I mean about let's connect the dots on these practices. How a core limiting belief could demean anybody else causes a lot of pain and a lot of harm. So we come back over and over and over again to trusting our own experience and surrounding ourselves by people who believe in us. Because when we surround ourselves with people who believe in us, or Elizabeth saying, "Oh my God, I've never met a more resilient person." And the value of seeing each other for who we are, no matter our age, that's love, right? That's awakening. And the last of these, abiding faith. This is the faith, the trust, the confidence that's grown from wisdom, that cultivates equanimity, becomes a continual resource for our practice. And this is again why I asked that question in our arriving meditation. What do you know to be true? What really holds you? What is a continual resource for you that you know from your own experience? And so I really invite you to let that be alive for you. What have you learned that you know really supports you, that is an outgrowth of this practice? And maybe that leads all the way to what the Buddha is said to have said in his penultimate teaching, that he said to his followers before he died, "Strive on with diligence. All conditioned things are temporary. Everything that is of the nature to arise is of the nature to cease. Strive on with diligence," meaning move into the future with confidence. You have a right to be here. So I wonder if you would be willing to share, what have you learned? What has given you confidence and trust in this practice? Or do you have any comments or questions? Let's take the next 15 minutes and talk with each other. I really do want to know, though, if you're willing to share, what are the teachings or what is a teaching that has really mattered for you? Anybody at all? Victoria, please.
Hi, Heidi. Thank you for this beautiful talk. The two sort of pillars for me that have really been life-changing in the last few years have been, on the one hand, the five remembrances. Mm-hmm. And so I hold on to those as just like a reality check, mm-hmm. just that it is how, that's how life is, and the wisdom of those five remembrances. And then and taking the fifth remembrance as a motivation to every day do what I can to make the world a better place. And then I have a gratitude practice with a friend that I met on Spirit Rock. I've never met her in the flesh yet, but it was either in your class or Grace's right at the beginning of the pandemic that I can't remember which class it was in, that we were talking about Dharma buddies, and she wrote in the chat that she wanted to have a Dharma buddy. And so I just wrote back and gave her my information. And to this day, we communicate daily with a gratitude practice.
Oh, beautiful.
And I added to it a daily Brahmavihara practice. And we're accountable to each other because we're doing it by text. And so we know, and, you know, if someone doesn't do it, then the other person says, are you okay? Is everything all right? You know, and it just feels really supported to have
so beautiful
right? to have that's, someone yeah. Yeah. What's that term, the Kalyanamita, I think, is that the right term for a mm-hmm. spiritual mm-hmm. friend?
Yeah
To me it's magic, because I've never even met her. I mean, I feel like she's my closest friend because we share this spiritual practice together.
That's so beautiful.
And take it seriously. So I would say, the five remembrances on the one hand, and the Brahmaviharas, and with gratitude added to that too. It just, every day I feel like, you know, whatever clouds have come in during the night, like with nightmares and things like that, these practices dispel them and give That's me the confidence so to go forward.
Thank you for that. I want to just say for everybody what the five remembrances are, and this is understanding that our humanity, our mortality, the truth of impermanence and loss, that we will go through periods of illness and wellness. We will lose those we love. We will be separated from everything we hold dear. We will die. We will go through, aging. Okay, that's the first one. So I was just drawing a blank. We're gonna age, right? We are going to age. We are going to experience illness. We will experience death. We will experience loss. And lastly, our happiness and unhappiness are up to us. The truth of karma, that everything we do, we are the primary recipient of all of our actions. So those five remembrances are powerful and important. And gratitude, of course. Thanks, Victoria. The most powerful thing or things for each one of us will be different. And again, that's the beauty of this, is find out what it is for you and do that. So isn't it beautiful that it doesn't have to be some complex academic teaching? You know, Wes Nisker, may his memory be of blessing, used to say, you are not your fault. And I remember the first time I heard him say, you are not your fault. And I thought, wait a minute, does that mean I'm not? Of course, I'm responsible for what I do. But that's worth thinking about. You are not your fault. What are all of the causes and conditions? What are all of our genetics? What are the five remembrances, right? All these things that just go into the karma of being. And we're still 100% responsible for ourselves and what we do. So it looks like it's 11:58. There's a blessing chant that I found in one of Jack's books that I would like to offer to you as our expression of dedication of merit. Just as water flowing in the streams and rivers fills the ocean, thus may all your moments of goodness touch and benefit all beings, those here now and those gone before. And I'll add, and those to come. Thank you, everybody, for being here. It's such a delight. Be well.